Welcome, everyone. This is the LaRue Show for Saturday, March 30th, 2013. I'm Marcia Mary Baker, and our topic for today is Glass-Steagall or Die. Now, I'm very glad we have two people on the front lines in the United States organizing to bring this about, that is Glass-Steagall, and that you'll hear all about this in the ensuing hour. One of them is right here with me in the studio from the LaRouche Political Action Committee, Tim Rush. Welcome, Tim.
Thank you, Marcia. Glad to be here.
And otherwise, our guest is speaking to us from Austin, Texas, and we're glad to welcome Dash Lee. Hi, Dash.
Thank you, Marcia.
Now, I want to begin with just a few words of introduction, and then Tim Rush is going to give us an overview on where this battle stands. But first, I'll just say to confirm some of you regular or other listeners that you know that the March 30th show is only the second one we had this month due to equipment upgrade. I'll put that in a polite way. We had some old equipment needing rehab. So we had our last show March 2nd, and I'm glad to say that was very transatlantic with Ron Weisorg from South Dakota and the leader of the LaRouche movement and the fight for Glass-Steagall in Europe in Italy, Liliana Guarini. So but the intervening Saturdays, we have been seeing to getting the equipment repaired, and also I hope you all know that March 23rd, near Washington, D.C., was an excellent policy conference on the paradigm shift we need toward development. It was on the 30th anniversary of the announcement by President Reagan of the Strategic Defense Initiative. But there was a conference all day, March 23rd, sponsored by the Schiller Institute. And you can find the write-up has begun in the latest EIR online that was posted about that. But now I want to turn again to the Glass-Steagall or Die, because I'll just refer you to our website, LaRouchePub.com, where you're listening to this live or on archive, because it was March 26 where we posted a press release by Mr. Lyndon LaRouche saying the system's already dead, so that's why it's Glass-Steagall or Die. He called on patriots to activate. That's what we're going to be discussing today. But just to repeat his words of warning, Mr. LaRouche said March 26, this country has no chance of survival without an immediate return to Glass-Steagall. And if the United States goes down, the rest of the world, starting in Europe and the rest of the Americas, is doomed. Now, I won't read the rest, but please look at that. But what I'd like to do is just to say, even though, let me just say it's plain as the nose on your face. Now, that implies that empirical evidence is good, which it isn't. It's bad methodology. But this system is gone. And for anyone who's a human, not just a furry creature, any human reaction, even if you make a mistake, is we need a new system. That's where Glass-Steagall comes in. It's the prerequisite to resume building a future for mankind, restoring nations, restoring essentials like food production, water, sanitation. Without a new system, in other words, without getting rid of burying the dead casino system of 30, 50 years of speculation and so forth, we have before us just disintegration of the apparent money system. We have an actual breakdown of physical conditions for people. And in the midst of this, then, that guarantees the likelihood of war in the midst of chaos that's involved in that, because you have some advocates for war who are really insane, the kind of neo-British Empire types that wanted a monetarist or imposed it to begin with, monetarist system. Now, I'll let it to our guests if they want to refer to any or to pick specifics that they want to bring out. But I just want to mention that if you want dramatic specifics of the breakdown, you just look at the transatlantic, our own region, and look across the pond at the Eurozone, where Cyprus, it's been announced during March, was put through this situation by the institutions of the Eurozone, that is the European Central Bank, the European Commission, and the IMF, where they, people who had deposits in banks, businesses, deposits, and so forth, over a certain size, they were told there had to be a bail-in. That's the word in case the terminology. You know what a bailout is, how lethal and toxic that is. Where a bail-in is if there's a bad bankrupt bank, which of course is part of the problem, anyone who might have money on deposit, not shares, not stocks, the money was just confiscated. Now that's going on in Cyprus. And the a version of it has gone on in Spain. A version of it's being discussed for Slovenia. And believe me, it's all throughout the transatlantic region. In fact, I just got a briefing an hour ago on the contents of a report, which is like a blueprint for how to use deposits if you have to for a bail-in of select banks. And this was written in December, this report I'm telling you about, that's a blueprint, jointly by the Bank of England, the BOE, and the United States agency called the Federal Deposit Insurance Commission. Now, this isn't law, but it shows the discussion underway of taking us even beyond the last few years of evil bailouts for Goldman Sachs, for J.P. Morgan, for anyone that Wall Street or City of London wants to bail out, into a more extreme version, which really is the chaos and breakdown version. So with just by saying that's where we stand at this time, and maybe Tim Rush will refer in particular to the timing, but, you know, Congress in the United States turned tail and took their break as usual when the world is not in a condition as usual. And so for Easter, Passover, spring break, Congress is out in its home district, or at least it isn't in Washington. But that doesn't mean we take a break by any means. Anyone who wants to have a radical shift out of this mess into getting back on the track of restoring real physical economic functioning again. So, as I've already said, but I want to just reiterate, Tim Rush in recent months has been in a special position of, with some colleagues, serving as a liaison between people on the state and local level around the country who are taking leadership to, in turn, bring that to bear on Capitol Hill so that the necessary action to get Glass-Steagall, to get it introduced in the Senate, where it isn't yet, Tim, I talk about that, but to get the bill, that's number 129, to reinstate it, enacted. I think, Tim, it has maybe 47 sponsors counting its originator, Marcy Kaptur.
That's correct.
Okay, that's the number. And I maybe there are more, but they aren't yet posted. There has to be mechanics of getting this done, and that won't take place perhaps until around the week of April 8th. But we are in the endgame phase. And just one more thing to this introduction to Dash Lee, speaking to us from Austin, Texas, and Tim Rush here, is that the overview on the moment where we stand in history is also the addressed in a new policy document by Mr. Lyndon LaRouche. He calls it just crux, or he says you might call it the end game. But that is posted on the LaRouchePAC.com, the Political Action Committee, and I think also, if it isn't, it will be soon on our own LaRouchePub.com. So, Tim, would you give us the overview on this, where things stand on the state and the federal situation?
Well, I think the first thing to emphasize is why bring in the states in the way that we're doing. It's obvious that Congress, if it were simply responding to the crisis, would long ago would have reenacted Glass-Steagall. We're just in an out-of-control incineration of any normal concept of banking when you have vast trillions of dollars pouring around the world in nanoseconds to try to capture a slight difference between the cost of borrowing money in Malaysia and putting it into 3 minutes of buying Brazilian bonds and then finding out how you can somehow make money putting it into a stock market for 3 hours. So the dysfunctionality of this system is clearest when you look at simply how much of the nominal assets of the banking system in the United States are actually lent out. Currently, it's only 72%. Historically, it was 95%. We've had the so-called quantitative easing policy of Ben Bernanke et al. Joined at the hip with what Mario Draghi, head of the European Central Bank, has been doing. And between those two operations, plus Bank of England, somewhere over $5 trillion of direct money issuance has gone into sustaining the too-big-to-fail and too-big-to-jail banks. Meanwhile, the amount of lending net has dropped by $1 trillion. And if people realize that the rationale for all the outrageous bailouts that have been going on over the last 5 years was to help Main Street, help banks get back to lending to the little guys, the just the basics of what keeps small business, farms, factories, and so forth going. We're looking at if you were a doctor and you were looking at an X-ray, you'd say this is dead. They just flatlined. So the need to put Glass-Steagall in is something that, whatever are the problems in Congress would long since have been restored. It was only taken off the books about 13, 14 years ago. However, we're up against, and this is something that our colleague Paul Gallagher, economics editor for EIR, stressed in the conference that Marcia mentioned last week. We're up, even among people in Congress who are in favor, are just devoted proponents of a restoration of Glass-Steagall to separate the commercial banks from all the garbage. They are totally pessimistic that this will ever occur. And they see a wall of money and pressure hitting them from Wall Street and from the White House as an instrument of the London and Wall Street policies. And they say, yes, all these, we have good, they're well-meaning efforts across the board to do something about this, but it ain't going to happen. We're perfectly happy to put our names down on this bill, but we don't see it's going to happen. So where do you break an impasse like that? And the question of going out to the states is the vital reservoir of political energy to be tapped. The states are certainly legislators typically are not full year, fully paid politicians. They tend in many states, and Dash will mention this from Texas, I assume, Texas only has its legislature meet once every 2 years. Other states have legislative sessions that are 2 to 3 months. A few very large states have them all year round. But by and large, people in a legislature hold other jobs. They're farmers, they're engineers, they're teachers, they may be lawyers or accountants or whatever, but they're closer to their communities. They find it much more – I mean, there's very little recompense for them to be thrown into the job of simply cutting budgets and having to absorb the pain of people who come to town hall meetings or hearings and scream if you eliminate the help for the for home care for the elderly or for people who need to be able to park their kids at daycare and they can't do it any longer. And they're really right up against the edge of the social and economic disaster that's hitting the country. So when we go out to the states and talk to the legislators, we are trying to recruit from among the legislators, in a sense, a reserve army, politically speaking, who will have the gumption to say we're not going to simply define ourselves as leaders in our states or attending to state issues per se. We're going to be a reserve task force that moves up to the front line as a national factor to break the impasse in Congress. Now, I have the good fortune to be in Congress on the day that the new session convened, which was January 3rd. There was a moment that was very illustrative where I was waiting in line in one of the receptions to greet one of the incoming freshman congressmen in this case. And in front of me were three people from JPMorgan Chase. who are all dressed very nattily and were chatting among themselves about, you know, to the effect of, boy, aren't we doing a favor to the staff in this new office to let them know we're here and leaving our cards so they can be sure to know how to contact us on any bill that we would need to instruct them on. And so I come along, and with the Glass-Steagall resolution, it was introduced, by the way, that very afternoon, the new form of it, 129, and bring forward the perspective of what the LaRouche movement is insisting on. It's toe-to-toe combat in Washington. Many of the legislators we talk to are very reticent about being involved on a national level like this and will often say, Congress won't pay attention, they disregard our voice, and so forth. The tremendous irony of this is that, and we know this from personal experience, vast majority of the congressmen who put their names down as co-sponsors of Glass-Steagall the last round, in 1489 in the last session, there were about 84 co-sponsors. Vast majority did it because they had people in their home districts or in their home states lean on them to do it, whether it was a resolution from some trade union, whether it was a letter or a resolution coming through from a legislator, maybe it was something from a farm organization, all kinds of ways that these things come in. And when the congressmen see that there is a mobilization in their home district that will back them up, in a certain sense, cover their back, because you're anyone in Congress who goes up against the Wall Street and London apparatus, augmented and given a very distinct shape by the White House involvement in trying to suppress a return to Glass-Steagall, they know they've got a big fight on their hands. It's very scary. If they're going to hold the line, and if we're going to expand this thing at a rate that really just becomes a juggernaut, the political reservoir coming in from the states is the largest untapped area that we could ask for, and it actually is the way a real republic should be working. You don't want to have – I mean, the Congress is so packed with lobbyists that it's unbelievable. Many of the state houses also operate where legislators just expect that anybody who walks in their door has some personal, is representing some association or some special interest, and they adapt to that. We bring in something that's very special and can tap something in the soul of these legislators, which is that they need to act above party. And it is very noteworthy that in the 12 states where we've been able to inspire resolutions calling on the U.S. Congress to reenact Glass-Steagall, in most of them, the sponsors and the co-sponsorship is bipartisan. And this is a very, very important quality. People are acting for the nation, above party, and above regional questions. When a legislator steps forward like this, it recalls to me a beautiful story of the 1920s and 30s on the federal level, which is the case of George Norris in Nebraska. George Norris, in the 1920s, a Midwest Republican in the Lincoln tradition, proposed the Tennessee Valley Authority. Now, if you take out your map and look at where Nebraska is and you look at the Tennessee Valley, you'll see that there's no overlap whatsoever. He was acting for the nation. And in the Republican Party in the 1920s, the Wall Street Republicans ran the show, and he got nowhere. The political opening of the election of Franklin Roosevelt in 1932 gave him and some other Republicans who wanted to put this through a climate in which it could proceed. And with the backing of Roosevelt, we got the TVA. Now, we have to be thinking today about recruiting on the state level people who are going to be exemplars of that kind of thinking and, in a way, bring out the same quality in the U.S. Congress. With the best people like Walter Jones, who's a co-sponsor of Glass-Steagall, the H.R. 129 with Marcy Kaptur of Ohio, is thinking exactly along this level. You can use the word maverick, but I would just say patriot. And we have to bolster the activity of those people on the national level by having people of a similar quality of mind and courage to emerge on the state level. So I think, Marcia, in answer to your question, where we are is we have 12 states with resolutions in, one state, South Dakota, with a absolutely magnificent mobilization from our activists there. Ron Wisorek, three weeks ago, filled people in on that. But there it passed in the House of Representatives of South Dakota by a vote of 67-2. Other places, it is going through committees. In some places, it died in committees. We are expanding constantly, and we'll be hearing from Dash in a second on work in Texas on this. But people should know that we have at least eight other states where there are decent prospects of getting a resolution in. A resolution is not the only thing we're asking them to do, but when you do have a resolution from anybody in one of these states, House, Senate, or both, I know from going personally to the State House in Virginia and in West Virginia, and we know it from many other places in the country, when you go in to see a legislator and on the top of the packet of material that you're presenting is a resolution in that State House, you have their attention. This is suddenly something that they see as their business. It's fully national and international in what we're asking them to conceptualize, but they suddenly see it as something that also overlaps their responsibilities directly in their state house. And that is a very, very important hook to get a deeper and more immediate response. But whether or not a resolution is in a state house or whether or not it moves forward like South Dakota, these legislators are being recruited, as I say, as a political reservoir. We're educating them constantly. When we contact them on Glass-Steagall, we're also bringing in the other areas of our program. New developments come in. We keep them updated. We are getting activists in other areas, in farm or union activity, water districts, community bankers, with many, many elements that have an intrinsic life and death interest in getting Glass-Steagall in. We're bringing forward to these legislators as well as the U.S. Congress. We're now feeding back when we get someone in the Congress moving forward, get it back to the states. So it's a very fluid situation that, as I say, really defines the way a republic should be working at this point.
Thank you, Tim. And I think, Dash, it would be good if you want to, you've been involved at weeks, if not months, in Texas, although I understand you're from the Great Lakes states, from Wisconsin, but you have been eyeball to eyeball with the state legislature, but also in one of the most important state economies in the world. The cattle situation is under siege. Texas, especially the western part, is in this horrendous drought. But why don't you pick up any of the elements that Tim was describing?
Yeah, I'll just start with about 3 or 4 weeks ago. I was in Austin for deployment with Natalie Lofgren. And, you know, we had been following the developments. There were, at that time, eight states that had introduced Glass-Steagall resolutions. We were really starting to focus on moving these states. And so Natalie and I decided, well, we should get into the Austin State House and not just get something introduced, but we should get something passed. We should get a Glass-Steagall resolution passed in the State House. Because we knew that if a state like Texas, California, Florida, Ohio, or New York were to do something like this, it would have a very profound effect. And we thought, you know, considering Texas, their current situation, and this was before the filibuster with you know, Ted Cruz and Rand Paul, but there was already, you know, a growing momentum that, you know, we had built up from the Keisha Rogers campaign and the work that had already been done in Austin. So we said, let's take this and let's try to move something and get it passed. So we started moving with the deadline in mind of March 8th as being the deadline for when a legislative bill should be filed. So we had that date in mind, so we have to get something in before March 8th. And went to a number of offices that were based on recommendations from the Houston office, our contact base, people who had been trying to organize their state legislators. We went to a number of those offices, set up meetings. And I had never done this before. I had never organized in the state house or in D.C. Natalie had done some work in Washington, D.C., and she was familiar with a lot of the people in the Austin state house as well. So she was a tremendous help to me to at least get me started thinking about, you know, who do we want to talk to? And what I was really amazed is that you can just walk in to the office, say, hi, I'd like to set up a meeting with the representative. If you're a constituent, you know, they also take you, you know, a little more seriously, but they are ready to talk to you. Most of the time you'll talk to an aide. You'll talk to somebody who's either the chief of staff or a legislative director for the representative. But we were able to get very quickly a number of meetings with representatives right before the March 8th deadline because they weren't yet in committee. And there was a lot more discussion going on. So we talked to a number of very good representatives who were, their normal jobs were, you know, farmers, businessmen, doctors. You know, considering that this, because they have these professions, they only get together about every 2 years because the other time they have to maintain, you know, their profession. So we had this time period. We were going to a number of offices, getting a lot of maybes. And at one point, we were in the elevator, and Natalie recognized that the gentleman with us in the elevator was the senator from the district that she grew up in. His brother used to be her principal at the school, and she recognized him and followed him out and said, Senator Lucio, you know, we have this resolution we're trying to get through. And he said, oh, yeah, I'm familiar with that. Just talk to my chief of staff, talk to my aide. And so we immediately went to his office, which we had had a very difficult time actually setting up a meeting with him. When we walked in, we were able to talk to his aide, who was familiar with Glass-Steagall. He knew what it was. He knew the importance of Texas introducing such legislation, and he also recognized the fact that it would be a very important for Texas to introduce it as a bipartisan piece of legislation. So the office agreed to carry the bill in the Senate, and we agreed that we would work to try and get a Republican joint author either in the Senate or in the House. And with that, he was able to draft the legislation before the March 8th deadline, sort of like at the last minute, and we thought, like, oh, well, we have the bill now. And there was a lot of excitement and intensity, but we never got a bill number. So by Monday, we were wondering, it was like, is there, you know, we want to find out the number, we want to kind of have it there as you know, yes, we filed it, you know, in Texas. Well, we found out that for a resolution, a resolution doesn't have the same deadline. A resolution can be filed anytime during the period, the 6 months while the legislature is in session. And so he did not file it. He drafted the legislation as a Senate concurrent resolution. And he said, we need to get a Republican co-sponsor, so this is a bipartisan bill from the get-go. And in discussion with him, it's like we realized that that was important. And since they had known that there was, we had this a little more room to maneuver because we didn't have a deadline to worry about. We started talking to as many Senate offices as we could to get a joint offer at the filing. And we talked to a number of good representatives, our senators, who were still on the, who are still on the fence, and we realized it was kind of moving slowly. But since it was a Senate concurrent resolution, we found out we could also get an identical piece of legislation in the House and try to move something more quickly in the House. So we were able to take this draft, photocopy it, bring it to all these different offices, and say, look, this is what we are working on getting in the Senate, and we need you to introduce something in the House. And we want it to be bipartisan. And started building up a grouping of senators and representatives who, even if they wouldn't carry it, would be willing to co-sponsor or co-author once the bill was filed. And so we continued just building up that momentum and seeing if we could move something in the House, get a Republican to perhaps carry it, and that would also fill the same need of making a bipartisan resolution across the two legislative bodies. And it was just really having to, you know, feel your way through the whole thing to find out who's going to bite, and meeting with as many representatives as we could and aides we could to move them on the urgency. And this is kind of where we're at now. We have this potential that's been built up, and what we really have to do now is find those with that kind of courage of General MacArthur to initiate it, because we've had, you know, we have one potentiality, and they'll file it. They've given their commitment to file the Senate resolution, irregardless. But we don't want it to be just a gesture. And, you know, that office understood it, and we understood it. We didn't want it to be a gesture. We want to get this passed. We want to get it introduced. We want to create the fight and the debate in the Texas legislature on this, because that would be much more effective. And so that's where we're proceeding from now, is organizing these offices, going back to them, getting them updated on the Cyprus situation, the developments that are going on across the pond, and what the implications are for the United States, which still includes Texas. And so we're yes. going from there.
Dash, let me ask you something. In many other states, we found a very healthy de facto alliance that involved elements that were breaking from their respective parties, not on everything. But, for instance, in Maryland, where one of the leaders of the Black Caucus was the sponsor, three people from the Eastern Shore in Maryland who were affiliated with the Tea Party joined in. And similarly, what I found out in West Virginia was you had a Democrat with a kind of Franklin Roosevelt outlook as the principal sponsor. But on the first afternoon of meeting with people, we came across a staffer in a Republican Senate office who was a devoted Rand Paul acolyte, and he immediately brought us around to meet with staff and several delegates who were part of an informal caucus very close to, Ron Paul. Anti-Federal Reserve, but picking up on the Glass-Steagall question, and we were trying to expand it beyond that. So we're finding this is very important, obviously, because right now many Tea Party groups are aware that nationally the Tea Party, some of the people who presented themselves as spokesmen for the Tea Party are real shills for the Peter Peterson crowd and Wall Street, little government, just shut down, you know, as another way to break the back on so-called entitlements. So they're kind of adrift, and you have people like move-on types who are very, for good reason, disenchanted with Obama. We had a famous case out in California toward the beginning of the year where leaders of MoveOn in the San Francisco area and some of the Tea Party people in that area got together. For 3 hours, they just banged their heads against each other and couldn't come up with any common ground until the Glass-Steagall question came up, and boom, suddenly they were practically hugging each other and going forward on a unified idea of getting Glass-Steagall in. Are you seeing something like that in what you're doing down in Texas?
Absolutely. Maybe not a lot of hugging, but, we have been seeing a really interesting back and forth. I mean, one of the first offices we met with was a Democrat who we had had a long relationship with through the Houston office. He's a very, very good guy. And he had carried a resolution in favor of 1489, two years ago, and really took a major beating from the Democrats because of, the whole LaRouche factor, people understood that Glass-Steagall was a LaRouche policy, and there was a lot of Democrats who were also, very still devoted to the Dodd-Frank, the hopes of Dodd-Frank or whatnot. So he took a bit of a beating, and the bill didn't, the bill died in committee, and so his focus was, you need to get a Republican to introduce this. I'll sign on, I'll join author, but you need to get a Republican to do this, and immediately gave some suggestions of people that he had been in discussion with who were Tea Party Republicans, and they disagreed on a lot of issues, but they had developed a rapport over, a period of time in which they could discuss politics and find a lot of common ground, particularly on some of these issues. We talked to a number of those offices who were somewhat familiar with Glass-Steagall, but they did understand the danger of the bankruptcy of the system and the Federal Reserve's money printing was a dangerous thing. And so we were able to get some good discussions across party lines because of what had already been generating between these much more progressive Democrats and Tea Party Republicans. A number of the ones who were very responsive to Glass-Steagall were doctors. I think that there's definitely you're not only dealing with the medical situation and Obamacare and all that, but you're also dealing with patients who are coming from a lot of different backgrounds, having to deal with a lot of difficulties. So you're probably getting a very significant influx of people from different backgrounds. So I can see definitely why doctors would, even if they're not familiar with Glass-Steagall itself, their understanding of what people are facing, being faced with, seems to have given them an insight. So,
let me pick up on one thing that you just mentioned, which is that when you said that some of the Democrats were a little, either wanted to cut more slack to this insanity of the Dodd-Frank or a Frankly Dud bill, whatever you want to call it, what's really behind that is they're just afraid to break with Obama. And what I found, and maybe you can comment on this, that one of the most useful things about what we're doing in the state legislatures with our three-part program, being Glass-Steagall as the essential first step, but only the first step, then the restoration of national banking and a national credit system, and then applying that to great projects like the North American Water and Power Alliance, reviving our space program, and fusion energy, and so forth. What you find is a very healthy way to take something that some people will like as part of that program and have them confront their own ideological blinders on the rest of the program. In the case of Democrats, you'll find a lot of them are responsive to a Franklin Roosevelt outlook. They identify with that. They don't like the big banks. They want to end the bailouts. They tend to like Glass-Steagall. But when you, but they have to face the fact that the White House, that Obama personally is on record saying he will never let Glass-Steagall be put back on the books. They've got to deal with that. In other words, we don't have to go into the state legislatures with a loyalty statement of, you know, you hate Obama and we'll, or we won't talk to you. We've got to have them pose the issue, the life and death question of reviving the lifeblood of a physical economy in this country where there are jobs, where young people have a future, where we aren't erasing old people and sick people in heartless budget cuts and so forth. They have to realize that that Glass-Steagall is the only way you're going to effectively reorient the entire machinery of the country to get out of that nightmare world. Once they do that, you don't have to stand on your head and say that there's a real problem with Obama. They'll figure – I mean, you force them to have a certain moment of recognition. They've got to be – they've got to acknowledge what in the back of their head they already know. Similarly with Republicans, who will often be very happy also to – oh, we don't like big the too-big-to-fail banks. They'll like the Glass-Steagall side of thing, and then suddenly they put on the brakes when you start describing – great projects like North America Water and Power Alliance, NAWAP, or whatever else. Oh, that's big government. That's going to be spending money. We have to cut the budgets. And they have this, or they have a very, a lot of them say, oh, I love Glass-Steagall. It's a step toward getting back to hard money, or we don't like what the Federal Reserve is doing. But they have no conception of what a credit system is, and in many cases, they're really very hostile to what's involved in that. So I've just found, and maybe you can, maybe it's been the same there, you get a very useful way in the way that we're going at the three-part program of getting the Democrats who have a Franklin Roosevelt tradition that makes them like great projects, like the modern TVA, NAWAPA, but are hesitant to take on Obama. They've got to deal with that. Republicans who have their own reasons why they might like Glass-Steagall but don't want big projects and don't want quote-unquote spending programs, they've got to break out of that. So I think we're in a very rich and fertile area for being able to get outside of the prison house of the way the parties have defined lists of outlooks or issues or whatever that at this point utterly cripple the ability of the country to move in real time with a crisis bearing down with this intensity.
Yeah, just a couple of quick examples. One of the representatives we first talked to, we explained to him that the Glass-Steagall was part of this larger program, and started getting into the NAWAPA and the water projects, and the guy lit up like a kid in a candy store, And so I said, well, if you want to talk about water, I got a few ideas, And he had this sort of riot, look on his face, and he had a little secret. And so we said, well, hey, if you want to talk about water, we should definitely meet up again about this. But we got to get Glass-Steagall first, otherwise none of this stuff is going to work. Another representative, and this is a Republican, and he worked in agriculture. We had another guy from the southern part of Texas dealing with this drought situation. We showed him the WAPA. He was absolutely blown away. He was wow. These are Republicans who are actually dealing with physical crises, and they are looking at what we're proposing as something that there may be big government or whatever. They are willing to overlook that because of the scope of what we're taking on. And there's an excitement that can be generated that is not party-based. It's only when people get, when we encounter sort of a pessimistic outlook about society in general, and that can be Democrat or Republican as well. Democrats who maybe like the idea of Franklin Roosevelt-style big projects, but they're pessimistic because of the environmentalist lobby and their fear of like, oh, the Republicans will never go with this, and that I think is when we find people that are breaking away from that, that there is a much larger potential for collaboration than people realize. And, I mean, my suggestion would be, like, anybody who's listening to this program should take, if they can, some time to go to the State House and just try to organize their representatives on this Glass-Steagall issue. And you would probably be very surprised about what you'll find.
You're actually raising, I mean, thank you for throwing me in that briar patch. One of the really extraordinary elements that has come to the fore in the work on the in these state legislatures over the last 3 months, basically, is being able to take our supporters, friends, people who are listening to this program and others who are around the LaRouche movement at any level and often over many years, and giving them an avenue to get into this fight, out of the barracks, up to the front lines. And so there's very notable efforts being done in certain areas where we don't have full-time organization. Minnesota's a good example right now where we have long-time supporters there. A couple of them are farmers. Others are retirees now. And they've been collaborating and getting up to the State House several times so far. Another visit is planned for next Wednesday and Thursday. We don't yet have a person ready to introduce a resolution, but and that is important, but their presence just walking the halls the way you describe, and what you said mentioned about it would surprise most average citizens that you can go into these state houses, you can actually go into the U.S. Congress and just walk the halls as well, but the state houses, you know, some of them don't have a lot of staff. You need to find out. You need to be fairly brash isn't quite the right word, but you got to look out. And as you were describing the elevator anecdote, you want to just talk to people, find out who are the legislators, catch them when they're leaving a committee meeting, going into a floor session, coming back at the end of the day. But what we bring, and this is something that people who are listening to this show and others that you know who are in and around the LaRouche movement, we bring a quality of acting for the nation, for the world, in fact, and for the future, which is a huge breath of air, fresh air for these legislators, even if they don't, you know, you don't know, I mean, they don't necessarily jump up and just say thank you. In some cases they're almost uncomprehending of what you represent, but you're tugging at something very profound. One anecdote, when I was out in West Virginia with one of our supporters there, a retired, previously was a music teacher among other jack of all trades, we went in to meet with a state senator who turned to our supporter and said, so why are you here? And it didn't compute. Our supporter just didn't really know what he was asking. And he sort of said, well, but what's in this for you was really behind the question. And our supporter, Tom, said, well, I'm not here for myself. I happen to think that hyperinflation, which is going to be the result of the Bernanke bailout policy, will wreck everything. And we won't have a country left if we don't put Glass-Steagall in now. The senator said, aha! So you're worried about higher gas prices and higher food prices. What we realized, and this was an extreme example. Most of them are much readier to, you know, think through what you're saying. He only gets lobbyists or other people coming through his office who have a particular axe to grind, a particular issue to get his agreement on in a yes or no kind of knee-jerk way, or lean on him because there's an economic benefit or problem arising from a piece of legislation. Acting for the country, and acting selflessly, is something that our supporters have to realize has an immense power when you get into these kinds of things. And that trickles into other areas. To move a legislator in California, for instance, we are going out to their local districts because the legislature itself is almost organized like a mini U.S. Congress. It's very hard to reach people there. Out in their districts, we talked to one of them who's just there for a parade. And we got the attention of the legislator at the parade, got a little bit of literature, but he said, meet me, talk to my staff, I'll meet with you when you get up to Sacramento. So people who can get involved in this, just know that you can look on your web pages, look on your look for your legislators' web pages, look for your congressmen's web pages, look for when they're going to be active or doing anything in your districts. Go there, get out some literature, talk to them, set up meetings. If you can't then get to the state house, in many places it is difficult because of distance and work schedules to get to a state legislature, we'll get delegations in there. And people can reach me. I'll give a phone number on that, and we can match up what we're doing in your state with what you want to do. You can call 1-800-929-7566. Ask for me, Tim Rush, and I, with other people here and out in the regions, we'll be able to match up what you can do with what we can bring around you in your states. But this is a very extraordinary quality right now of interaction between our activist base with our full-time people who have been with the LaRouche movement for years, with the a grouping in between of people taking on leadership in many institutions. This is one of the most exciting developments that's occurred in the last several months, and we want to just push this, just go like the wind.
Yeah, I just want to make one quick recommendation on that, is that if you go to the state house, go to the first place you might want to go is the gift shop or the bookstore, or sometimes they have like a legislative library. But often, I know that the Texas state house has these little directories. They're like a very small pocketbook with the pictures and the contact info and the room number for all of the senators, all the representatives, and you can go and you can use that as a guide. I found this, almost a week within organizing there and realized, hey, this is extremely useful. So, that'll be helpful. There's also online guides you can find. The other thing I should talk to you about, Tim, is we can probably put together packets of resolutions from the other states so that they have examples people can bring in. Because that was one thing that we used. You could just put a packet down and say, hey, look, these are all the resolutions from other states. You should draft one like this to help. Help them, get things going. And at this point, we're going to need a lot more people organizing from their districts, people who we talk to in the field. At this point, we need to get the momentum coming from the population to the representatives to say, hey, you need to introduce this resolution. You need to sign on to it. Glass-Steagall is not just about Texas, it's about the country. We're going to lose the country having that kind of vocal support because, we do a lot of work setting up these meetings, talking to representatives, explain to them what Glass-Steagall is, but a lot of times we just talk to their aides. And the aides can pass on to the representatives. But people who are in the districts who actually know their representatives should be talking to them about Glass-Steagall and how important it is. And that way, something comes up in the office where they say, oh, wasn't there somebody in there to, discuss Glass-Steagall? Maybe we should get him in. We should talk to him again. So that helps us too.
Right. One thing, the combination of what you're saying specifically about Texas or West Virginia or something, it impresses me in these 12 states that Tim Rush mentioned that have actual texts of resolutions, that if you have the initiative you're describing that people have to give, corner the lawmaker, the congressman, or people who can bring to bear pressure on them, that the context is so dramatic and so extreme. I'll take the case of Pennsylvania. There could be many where there's a resolution text was introduced. The state capital's in bankruptcy. The last 2 or 3 years, the city council of Harrisburg, the capital of Pennsylvania, has been in a turmoil about whether they would be under state receivership, official government bankruptcy, federal law. Every place you go, you just mentioned, Dash, water in the state of Texas is life and death. Pennsylvania, that was once a steel, coal, and dairy center, is now bankrupt, the whole state. So your call to people around the country to go for patriots to activate is taking place in a context that couldn't be more vivid. Hawaii comes to mind, Tim. One thinks of the beauty of the place, but of course, since it's a set of islands, its transportation, its school system, I mean, its actual economic base is desperately disintegrating. And there the resolution was introduced in mid-March, I believe, for Glass-Steagall. So it's a solution that's ready to crystallize. I guess that's what we're talking about. Is there anything else you want to add in the final minutes, Tim?
Well, just to follow that up, we're finding on the state level that about the only group that is sort of poking its head out visibly to try to oppose our efforts. There's a lot of behind-the-scenes stuff.
Yeah, give us the dirty operations.
A lot of these states, it gets thrown into things like a rules committee where you have one or two people who pull all the strings and people just sort of wait for the diktat to come down. But in some cases where you can have hearings, the effect of the organizing in a certain way transcends the specific result in terms of a resolution. Maryland is a good example. We had a magnificent hearing in front of the Rules Committee approximately a month ago where a number of our supporters came forward, someone who has a business and has a payroll of about 50 people. He's always on the edge. He said, why do these huge monster criminal bank syndicates get bailed out when I'm being pushed to the wall? And I don't have anybody I can turn to make sure I can meet my payroll. Other people, retired person, I think he was in some skilled machinist type of thing, a carpenter was in there. We had quite an array of people who gave extraordinarily powerful testimony, very direct, very real. Now, the only group there that testified against our effort to restore Glass-Steagall were some people from the Maryland Banking Association. And in many states, you have a split. You have a banking association, which really involve the local sort of stooges. I mean, it's a strong word, but in most cases, that's what they are, stooges for the big banks, the too big to fail. Some of them are better meaning and some worse, and some can be broken from the allegiance to the big banks. But by and large, that level is stepping in. In Rhode Island, there have been hearings on our resolution in both the Senate and the House there. In both cases, a Rhode Island banking lobbyist stepped up to try to say, no, we don't want Glass-Steagall, and to repeat Wall Street lies about why we don't want it. However, most of the community banks are very much inclined for Glass-Steagall. They tend to be, they see themselves as small fry, but we're instrumental in bringing them forward. The reason I'm mentioning this is in Maryland, we were able to handcuff the person who was giving this testimony, and they were just, they realized in the force of our citizens' movement, anybody trying to justify what's going on right now is confessing themselves to be a criminal. And that, you know, even these lobbyists felt abashed by the force of what we'd marshaled there. So even though the head of the Rules Committee then stepped in just a couple of days ago and ruled off the schedule all resolutions, ours and every other one, we don't have time for it or whatever other reason was given, and just high-handedly said no. So, but what we accomplished has shaken that state house. The quality of our movement that has developed around that fight is now ready to continue, not only getting the individual legislators who are with us now active. They're not very far from Washington. They can go, and a legislator who goes to Washington, D.C., and we built the movement to inspire that legislator to do it, is a phenomenal additional impact on Congress to kick their backside right now. These people can write letters. They can mobilize other elements to focus on Congress. Something really beautiful emerged there. So we're finding that, you know, the enemy is quite aware that we're active and we're making breakthroughs on the state level. But the kind of what you've been describing, Texas Dash, kind of thing that's been going on in Maryland and elsewhere, this thing has no procedural limit. The only limit is the intensity. And I there's a phrase that I like to use, and maybe we could wind up with this, is simply we need to constantly increase the political energy flux density of the work. And for those of you who have been following Mr. LaRouche's work over the years, you'll be familiar with the idea of energy flux density, example being essentially what is the at the point of action or of work, how much what are you bringing to bear? A sharp knife versus a dull knife, you can have the same pressure with your hand on it, but the sharp knife is going to cut through much faster. People can imagine other examples of energy flux density. Political energy flux density is not measured by one-on-one interactions, but the entire field of political motion that we're generating. And so we're going to be finding lots of surprises and combinations. Every state will be different. The input from developments around the world will constantly be shaping this, and we're the instruments to make sure people are really in real time, in the real world on this stuff. But if we can increase this idea of political energy flux density around the powerful ideas and solutions that we have to a crisis that's obliterating nations and peoples, then we should be very optimistic about what we can do.
Well, thank you. And that does sum it up. And I want to thank Dash Lee, who's speaking to us from Austin, Texas, with the LaRouche Political Action Committee there. Tim Rush, who is here in the studio with us, but is in liaison with people all around the country regularly on this. We should go for the maximum. Everything you just said, it couldn't be more urgent. It is life or death. And I want to thank everyone for participating today. This is March 30th, 2013, and we'll be back April 6th, 2013. Thank you very much. This is the end of today's LaRouche Show.